The funny thing is, I had that game and I never played it, and I traded it in, wrapping intact.
I love being a troll because you just get to piss so many people off.
What would you rather be inside of? A giant robot or magical girl?
Now we're stuck with you.
I'm pretty sure I'm on a higher plane of existence than you.
I was just about to bring that up. Nintendo, I'm not even going to say anything.
We shall give you a quality show today. I'll be giving you at least 78%.
Launching!
Hello, everybody. Indeed, welcome to an episode of Anavision EXT. I am J-Ro, joined by Amuro.
What up?
And for anybody that has not heard any of our EXT episodes before, the term EXT can take on a couple of meanings, either extended with more discussion from a previous numbered episode of the podcast, or extra, which is what this episode is, which is just an entirely different discussion. And today we are talking about the Kizu Monogatari series. We're going to be talking about the first movie. We'll start with that discussion first. So if you have not seen it yet, it came out in theaters just recently. And then after that, we are going to be talking about the entirety of the Kizu Monogatari light novel. So anybody who's watching the movies, you'll definitely want to kind of steer clear of that until all the novels have been adapted into anime.
Yeah, so we're going full spoilers for the whole thing here.
Yep. So let's get into this movie first. We'll start with the first movie, Taketsu Hen. And it is, in the terms of animation, very different, very unique for a Monogatari series. There's quite a bit of CG use, which you don't see that much in the anime, in TV anime, and you expect that to be the case because it's, you know, a full-blown movie. They're going to go big with the animation. Mm-hmm. So, but the CG use it worked pretty well, I thought. It looked pretty nice. There's spots where, I mean, you kind of see it as like, that's just some CG. It's nothing really impressive. Like, you know, you see like cost cutting there or something.
Yeah, there was a couple scenes where you notice the CG for the characters, particularly when there's one shot where Adaragi was going downstairs and the camera is looking at him from above. The UCG for that character model. And then like one where Kiss shot and Adaragi are walking away from the camera and it's, you know, a long distance shot and they're clearly CG models. But I think in those cases, you get a pass for using it on the characters just because they're small. Like on camera, they're very small, so it would be hard to give them detail, you know, in a hand drawn sense. But what they really used the CG for to great effect was in the backgrounds, mm-hmm. and it really gave them this detailed, you know, they weren't Monogatari backgrounds, right? Like you really had like a sense of the world around them. It was still as empty as it ever was.
Right. Yeah.
in the rest of the series, because again, you know, this is a series that focuses on a few characters at a time. And it's really intimate with those characters. So the rest of the, you know, there's no background characters, mm-hmm. and you're used to that if you've seen the series or read any of the books. But here the characters really stand out against the world that they're in because, again, it's almost all CG. The characters most of the time are fully hand-drawn. So in particular, one scene that sticks out to me is Adaragi walking around the cram school, right? Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, very fluidly animated, but he stands out from the world, the environment that he's in, because it's all CG. And I think it works really well.
Oh, yeah. And I was just kind of thinking about this versus all the other Monogatari series we've seen, and the difference in like color in this, in Kizu, the first episode, mm-hmm. where I was kind of looking at some of the Bakemono episodes recently and seeing the cram school in there and how it's stylized there, where a lot of this movie is kind of like kind of dark, mm-hmm. kind of brown. There's a scene outside the school that looks really nice with the sunset and Hanakawa and Adaragi talking.
Yeah, and the but it, what's interesting is that like the art style in Kizu isn't particularly interested in having any continuity with the rest of the Monogatari TV series whatsoever, right? So like his the cram school, the actual high school, the you know Adadagi's house, everything doesn't look the way it does from a design standpoint that it does in the series.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of wanted to separate themselves a little bit from the rest of the show. And in particular, the cram school, where it's really, you know, it's abandoned here in the movie, but like it's very sterile, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's, you know, it's completely, you know, the best way to describe it is white, right?
Yeah.
So like as he's walking around, of course, you know, you're expected to be run down. There's still a tree, you know, growing through the middle of the school, but it's very, like I said, very sterile and it stands out.
Yeah. For something that is abandoned, it looks immaculately clean.
But yeah, I guess we should, before we go further, we should just talk about Kizu Monogatari itself, right? Like a little bit of the background, like, you know, as part of the Monogatari series, it actually is the third novel.
Yeah.
In the series.
It was Bakemono was written first.
Yep.
And then Nekomonogatari Black.
It's actually two volumes of Bake.
Okay.
Yeah, so two volumes of Bakemonogatari, then Kizu. God. These Japanese names, but Kizu Monogatari was the third novel, and it was actually a prequel to Bakemono, which it's referred to and mentioned kind of like in passing, or like, oh, the things that happened during spring break, this and that happened during spring break. We finally get to see those events in Kizu Monogatari. So despite it being the third novel in the series and the prequel to the whole thing, it is just now getting animated.
Yeah.
Even though it was announced long ago.
Yeah, I had seen, I was looking on Metanorn for like an old Kizu Monogatari post, and it dated back to 2010, where the person that posted, former guest of the podcast, Flags, actually had posted like pictures of what Guillotine Cutter dramaturgy and episode looked like. And in my head, I was kind of going into the movie expecting that look, and
yeah,
it looked pretty different, but that was it's one of those things where it's like, at last we finally have a movie that we've seen and have been waiting for so long, because we've seen episode in the anime,
yeah,
and we've, you know, we were talking after the movie with one of our friends that's seen it, and he was talking about remembering things from the TV series that he brought into the movie with him because he hadn't read the book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting discussion on like spoilers in the series, when if you've watched enough Monogatari and have connected all the dots, you could kind of get an idea of where things go.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting because we know where it's going to go. Like, even if you have just seen Bakemonogatari, you know how the story supposedly is going to end.
Because
mm-hmm. you know that Adadagi is a former vampire. He was a vampire at one point, but now he's not quite a vampire. And Kishot is still a little girl who, at the, you know, during Bakemonogatari, she never says a word, and she doesn't even have a name because she's just a remnant of what she was before, mm-hmm. right? And she eventually becomes known as Shinobu. But even in the novel itself, at the very beginning of the novel, it tells you how it's going to end.
Right.
This is a story that does not have a happy ending for anybody.
Oh yeah, it's like Fate Zero.
Yeah,
it's not a happy ending.
But talking again about the movie itself, 6 years in development. This was directed by Mamoru Oshii.
Yeah.
Let me make sure I get that. I get that right?
Yeah, and Shimbo was the chief director.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, Shimbo he's credited on all of Shaft's works, but it's like those main directors are really the ones doing the actual work. if I should say. Like, Oshii is most notable for being, he was a director during Bakemonogatari. So he's kind of like the one responsible for the style that kind of became, that Monogatari became known for.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you look at Bakemonogatari and then its immediate sequel, Nisemono, there is kind of a very, you know, there's a difference there. And Bakemono is a little bit more abstract, and it does more of the cutaway dialogue, text on screen, and, you know, a little bit crazier. Whereas Nisemono kind of settled down a little bit, and that sort of became the mood for the rest of the series, right? So it's interesting to see Oshii come back here and really stretch his wings in the directorial style of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because even comparing it to Bakemonogatari, it's extremely different.
Yeah. I was kind of thinking about that, like, in terms of reading the book and then watching the movie. Like, this is the first time I've read, and maybe this is the case for you, reading a Monogatari novel and also having read that before seeing the animated product of it. So for that, it was really interesting, because reading the book, we get so much of Araragi's inner dialogue, which is to be expected because he's the main guy. He's there in every scene, so he's telling the story. But it was interesting to see with how Shaft applies their flavor to Monogatari.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, this was my first experience reading the source material, then watching it, the adaptation. All my other previous experiences with Monogatari had been just mainly through watching the anime. And of course, that's because Kizu was the first novel actually published fully in English by Vertical over here in the United States. So we got the whole thing in English. And of course, when I saw that was coming out, I jumped on that right away. But like you said, you know, it's reading the prose, it really, it kind of informs you as to why the Monogatari TV series is done the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like the series really takes that first person narration and runs with it. I'd say that the Monogatari TV series is a more direct adaptation of the novels. Mm-hmm. And of course I'm only saying that based on, you know, the style of the novel, of the TV show, plus what I've read of in Kizu, right? In the way that they adapt the narration and the dialogue and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the visuals are more, they're there to be a little bit more metaphorical,
mm-hmm.
right? And to sort of spice it up a little bit, whereas really the main thrust of it is the dialogue. Whereas in the novel, all that narration, in the movie adaptation of Kizu, all that narration and internal monologue that Araragi has is almost completely left out of the movie.
Right. And I was kind of expecting, like we've seen in other Monogatari series where they've kind of done those super quick cuts of like various lines of dialogue that they would leave in. I was kind of expecting a lot of that. So I was surprised, and I guess pleasantly so, that they didn't do that so much, because it's so quick to read, and for anybody that hasn't read the novels, I feel like that, I'm kind of thinking now, like, that would be really difficult to really just, like, you know, okay, pause, and then go forward another frame.
Well, even that, most of those quick dialogue, or, you know, the most of those sentences that are put up on there are direct quotes from the novels.
Yeah.
Right. So I half the time I'm like, are those even meant to be read? Because they're on there for such a short amount of time. But I was also glad to see that it was mostly absent from the movie itself. Mm-hmm. It was still used, but I feel like it was used sparingly and more effectively that way.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the red and black screens. Right. You know, black, of course, signified the darkness that a vampire would be, you know, so used to, and the red for the blood, which again showed up very often there. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting was, you know, how in the TV series it's usually red and black, black screen in kanji. Here in the movie, it was in French.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking, like, what the heck? Like, how about translating that?
It's like, as long as you know rouge means red and yeah. noir means black, you'll get by just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, that, you know, that narration was all almost completely gone. But, you know, what that narration serves is for us to get inside Araragi's head.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did was they used the visual medium to portray all that, and not just the visual medium, but also the audio as well.
Right.
You see it in the way that Araragi's eyes dart back and forth when he's, you know, in a mm-hmm. tense situation, or his heavy breathing, or the yeah. you know, the lack of music, or, you know, all of that was used to great effect to really get all of that stuff across. And yeah.
I think most notable scene of that being when mm-hmm. he first saw Kiss Shot.
Oh yeah, jeez, man, talk about tension. But like I said, I think that was really great. Having read the novel, I feel like that was especially great because, you know, you read the book, you know what's already in his head. So I think that the job of an adaptation is to put that on screen. And instead of having him tell you it, it's great to be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So right. So in that situation, I think it worked really great.
I agree.
And it was helped. Especially by the quality of the animation.
Mm-hmm. How about we go sort of scene by scene with the movie? So
yeah.
I believe we start with an in media res. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
That's right.
Of Araragi walking outside and eventually burning by the sunlight.
That's one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie right there. Just you know, the shock of seeing him walk around this unfamiliar territory, and you know, that was I think a great thing too, a great decision for changing the design from the TV series, because to Araragi it's an unfamiliar territory,
yeah.
and then for us as a viewer who's long been accustomed to the Monogatari series, we know that cram school. For it to be so different, it now becomes an unfamiliar scene for us,
right,
and the viewer as well. And like I said, that, you know, that scene where he finally steps outside, and the very abstract nature is still there, because of course as he's walking outside, it looks almost like a medieval tower, you know, with the bricks and all of that, so, or a clock tower even.
Mm-hmm.
But as he steps outside and you see, first before you ever see him catch on fire, you see the horror on his face as he realizes that his hand is on fire, and you see his hand slowly come on screen, and you're like, oh, and then the uh-huh. rest of them follow suit. And I'm like, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's like instant burst. And then I believe he falls off the building like a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even before like, that first sequence of the movie, of course, that's like right up to the title screen or whatever, but it cuts immediately to where the book proper starts, and Araragi is having his first encounter with Hanakawa.
Yeah, and so that was, I think, reading that scene, it's one of those like, oh, you can't wait to see that animated, just because of the panties, of course, and then the awkwardness that follows that scene. I wasn't expecting such frilly lingerie.
Yeah, yeah. It's what's almost interesting is that like every version of that panty shot, the one that we see at the beginning of Bakemono, the one in the movie, and the one in the book, she's wearing different things every time.
Yeah.
But I think the impact is definitely still there. They went for a very grandiose. You know, the burst of wind that comes through is like hurricane force.
Yeah.
but yeah, I think they handled that scene particularly well. For, you know, that's kind of what set everything into motion right there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think it's a little ridiculous that the whole franchise starts with that one panty shot. But I think they handled it really well here. Again, the most important thing was the first meeting between him and Hanakawa and the conversation they have. In the book, of course, you get a lot of narration from Araragi talking about how, you know, how he's a loner and the intensity of his of himself as a human, and,
right.
and that's why he doesn't have friends and all that stuff. But we get all of that just from their first encounter in the movie, right? So mm-hmm. the way that the way that when he encounters her, he's kind of trying to avoid her because he's like, I didn't see anything. And she says his name, and his first reaction is, how do you know my name? Right? Like, you kind of get from there where you get the feeling that he's not used to talking to people.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And again, you know, the back and forth between them was handled really well. That was the most, it's like that conversation and later in the movie, his conversations with Kiss Shot and Oshino were the most Monogatari that the series was, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like if you watch the TV show and you know what to expect when they start bantering with each other.
Right. They really did some work on the boob animation. Like there were a couple scenes where I'm like, that is really some ridiculous drawing there.
You're like, she is gigantic.
Yeah. She's like more so than the series, but that's a good point about like talking about the writing of the light novel versus the anime, is that while reading the light novel helps add all this depth to Araki's insight, the anime does well enough to portray that from the characters.
Right.
And then a random car out of nowhere just crashes.
I thought that was one of the funniest I think one of the funniest scenes in the movie. And the one that got a lot of play from the audience, a lot of laughs from the audience.
Yeah.
The timing on that was great. The fact that it comes back on screen later.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you must ask, listener, that was a CG car. They're always. All right, so the next, after that, another scene that was really funny was Artodoggy, you know, reflecting back on the day mm-hmm. and those panties and thinking, I need to see more of that. so he leaves, goes to the magazine store. You see a like a cutout looking of his body, like charging through the wall, not even going for the automatic doors to get the magazines.
Oh yeah, that was also hilarious when you know the fact that he's in his room, the clock is ticking, and he just, and again, that's where the whole narration from the book comes in mind, where he's talking about how the image of her panties were just burned in his, like, in his eyelids. One of my favorite lines of the book is when he talks about, if my eyes had been removed and transplanted into somebody else's head, I'm sure that they would also be seeing Hanakawa's panties. That's how burned into his eyeballs they were. But, you know, again, you get that sense that, like, you get all of that from the animation. Like, when we kind of go into his perspective, and his eyelids close, you see a flash of her panties, right? And again, like, you're like, he cannot get this off his mind. So he walks casually out of his house, and then he turns around and goes into the running start position.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, like, the background is he's on a railroad, and I'm like, what in the world is, like, why is he on on train tracks? And as he takes off and he's running faster than a speeding train.
Yeah, speeding bullet.
and you get that steam engine sound behind him. I'm like, oh, I get it. Uh-huh. But, you know, he went with the quickness and like you said, didn't even stop for the door, went just straight through the wall, got those dirty magazines. And of course, that leads to his first encounter with, one hot-blooded, cold-blooded vampire.
Yeah. Iron-blooded, hot-blooded, yet cold-blooded. So he walks out, and as we were mentioning earlier, desolate. Nothing is going on. No cars, no people. It's just Araki in this city all to himself, it would look like. But he sees that the lights go out in the city, all the power goes out, and then he sees blood in the subway, goes down, and sees Kiss Shot with all of her limbs taken from her.
Yeah. And that description also almost doesn't even do it justice, because he was following that blood trail for the longest time.
Yeah. And he was stepping into blood.
Oh yeah. 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 Like it felt like, for, you know, it's kind of interesting because if I remember correctly in the novel, it basically just happens on a street level. Like,
yeah, he's walking, that's what I was surprised.
Like, and on the side of the road, he sees her underneath a street lamp. Right. Here they kind of keep that same thing where he's, you know, he sees some blood under a street lamp, but he follows it into a subway, and he goes down for what feels like a mile, all the while following this blood. You know, he's breathing hard, and finally when he sees her, he just freaks right the fuck out.
Yeah, I was thinking when the lights were all turning off in succession that only one was gonna stay lit, and that's
she'd be under it, right? But no, they went for the more surreal route.
Yeah. I like that better,
yeah.
I think. It makes sense to, like, you know, build up the suspense of following this very lengthy blood trail leading up to her. And then the scene of just, like, seeing her decapitated and actually picking her up and throwing her and starting to run away. But then for some reason going, I'm going to give her my blood. I'm going to save her.
Yeah. I think, again, it was handled really well. Again, no narration here. It was all, you know, we all saw it from his, you know, we saw the emotions on his face. But when she first sees him and her haughty attitude, her, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that even though she's a stump, you know, bleeding out on the floor, she still sees herself as above him.
Uh-huh.
Right. And she says to him, I will allow you to save me, to give me your blood. Like it's some sort of noble thing for him to do, to just give his life away. And you know, he does what I think anybody would do. He runs away at first.
Yeah.
And that sort of breaks her.
Right.
You know, because it's like she's finally realizing that she's really going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it sort of all comes crashing down on her. And then to see such a proud, you know, such a proud being just crying on the floor, you know, apologizing over and over. Like,
go Mendesai, go Mendesai.
God, like even in the book when I was reading that, that to me was a powerful scene, because she's just over and over again apologizing, you know, begging for her life essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Adedagi at this point, he can't resist.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's the sort of thing where, like, that whole intro about him talking about his intensity as a human, him being a loner, this and that, and even the conversation with Hanekawa, where she mentioned that, you know, a vampire is a higher being than a human, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically like he knows he's going to die if he does this.
Uh-huh.
And something in the back of his head tells him, you know, like, she's a vampire. You don't need to save a vampire or what's essentially a monster. But for him, it's like, I can't leave someone in need of help.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but, you know, giving my life for something like this, you know, that's a way to go.
Right. Then next up after that, we see that Koyomi wakes up in the cram school with Kishot sleeping on his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And she has the appearance as the book. I don't think they ever really mentioned it in the anime, that Araragi described her appearance as that of a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
And then that's where we see him sort of a more lengthy scene of him walking around the cram school and then burning before Kishot comes in and saves him and drags him to the parking garage.
She does the most amazing dive off the roof.
Uh-huh. Like she was a swimmer.
Yeah. a literal dive. And you know, the way she catches on fire as she's, you know, falling down was really quite a sight to behold. Mm-hmm. And her dragging his flaming body back under, you know, underneath the into the shadow was great.
Yeah. And then after that, we see them walking around the cramp school, and then that's where, you know, we get to see some of that traditional Monogatari dialogue between Kishot and Araragi.
Yeah, that's pretty much where we got, like, at this point, this is where we get all the exposition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she talks about why she was there, the three vampire hunters that got her when she got into town, and how now that he's her servant, he can, you know, take them down, get her limbs back, and so she can go back to being at full power, and, you know, she can return him back to being human.
Right. And then Koyomi encounters these vampire hunters. We see Dramaturgy, Episode, and Guillotine Cutter come from different sides, different areas of this I'm trying to think of, it was like a nuclear power plant looking or something.
Oh yeah, like a factory zone, you know.
Yeah.
And then, a very, very unnatural, but like, you know, detailed in crazy quality because of the CG. And he's essentially at a bypass, you know, he's surrounded on all three sides by these guys. And, mm-hmm. and the whole conceit of this was, you know, she's like, don't worry, you're my servant. You know, you're not weak. All you have to do is take them on one at a time.
She makes it seem so easy.
And immediately he's surrounded by all three of them.
Uh-huh. And then that's where we are introduced to Oshino Meme, who, when you see him in Bakemono, he has this cool mystique about him. He seems like this mysterious guy, but there's something in this movie where he's just a badass.
Oh yeah,
he gets this scene where he's jumping like he's in Naruto and stuff.
Yeah, where he's running, dashing across, and again, like I think this could be considered the climax of the movie.
Right,
because they really went all out in portraying how really powerful Oshino actually is. Because
mm-hmm.
you never actually get to see it in Bakemonogatari. Like there's the one encounter with a crab where he, you know, touches something that he shouldn't be able to touch and body slams it on the ground. But you know, here we see him like jump off this tall structure and land with the incredible force, and he's dashing at crazy speed. And he jumps in as these three, you know, vampire hunters about to jump in and kill Adaragi. He jumps mm-hmm. in and stops all three of them easily. You know, like he literally catches one dude's swords between like his fingers and stops a giant cross with his, you know, sandal.
Right.
and you're like, oh, yeah, he really is the real deal.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was a really cool scene on the animation front. And then, sort of to close out the movie, Adaragi and Oshino talk and kind of establish like how he's at this cram school and setting up the barrier and that. And then they add Kiss Shot to that as they sort of talk about the plan to take down these three vampire hunters and get her limbs back.
Yeah. The movie essentially ends on Meme and Oshino agreeing to help Adaragi. Like he's agreeing to help him, you know, make it fair.
Yeah.
So that he can confront these three vampire hunters, because Oshino Meme, he's there just for balance.
Right.
So, and that was the end of the movie.
For 5 million yen.
Yeah. You know, a cheap sum.
Yeah. Or wait, was it free?
I think it was like 3 billion yen, yeah.
Yeah, I think he upped it to 5 at some point. I may have given away a spoiler there. and then the movie ends there. So I think, having, you know, without spoiling any more about the novel, I think you and I both have a sense of where we think movie 2 will end, which the trailer at the end said summer 2016.
Yeah.
And then movie 3, where things will take over to finish it off.
So for those people that are only watching the movies, this first movie was about only an hour long. It covered the first 6 chapters of the novel itself, which in the English translation is about 100 pages.
Mm-hmm.
I that was a bit controversial. I guess we might as well talk about that now. The decision to separate it into 3 movies. And I guess this is sort of a trend that we're seeing now in a lot of things. I mean, you know, Evangelion did it first, but, you know, back like in 2007. Yeah. But even like in Hollywood, we're seeing a lot of things get broken up into several parts. And, you know, when you think like, oh, did The Hobbit really need to be 3 movies?
Hmm.
And yeah, in this situation,
it's going to be 9 hours. And yeah.
Yeah. In this situation, I guess it works a little bit better because there are 3 movies that altogether are going to be 3 hours, as opposed to 3 3-hour movies for a short book.
I think there are some forms of media where you can have a very specific feeling on what works and what doesn't. But I think in this case, I think you could have done an anime series. You could have done mm-hmm. 4-episode OVA. It probably would have worked fine. You probably would have lost some things along the way, especially if you went the OVA route. you would have not had as much budget or mm-hmm. and I think that's one thing that helps it being movies, and you know, the decision to make it three movies or just one, I don't know, is entirely relevant as far as like the animation quality is concerned.
You know, but I mean, like the big criticism that you see all the time is, oh, it's a cash grab. Oh, they just want to, you know, milk it for all it's worth. And I'm like, you know, that's unfair, because right. you know, this is something that takes a lot of time and effort to make. Why? And it's not, you know, the whole point of anime as an industry is to make money, right? Yeah. In the first place, it's an art form, but at the same time, it's also a business, and you know, this is something that clearly they've been working on for 6 years,
mm-hmm.
and they're finally trying to get, you know, put it on screen. And you know, if they want to make it three movies, then they're going to make it three movies. Realistically, the question then is, can this movie stand on its own?
Yeah.
And I'd say no, it really can't. Like, it's not meant to serve as a standalone experience. It really should be more part of the whole. That's why I think that reading the novel beforehand is almost a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, we had some people in our group that were there watching the movie with us, and again, I think we're just really lucky that we actually got to see the movie in theaters, you right. know, in the first place, because it got very limited screening across the U.S. and you know, there was a theater close to us that actually got it. So this is definitely, it's certainly a movie that an experience that should be experienced in a movie theater, but at the same time, it's like, you know, there were some people in the crowd that hadn't read the book. They weren't Monogatari fans. They were there just to, you know, see what was up. And I guess they enjoyed it
mm-hmm.
to an extent. You know, the visuals were great, but then like the story just kind of ends, you know?
Right.
He's like, oh, I'll help you. And then credits roll.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely a Monogatari fan movie. Like, there's like, you know, sometimes I think we talk about like the disappearance of Haruhi Suzumiya and yeah. how great of a movie that is, and how we always make it a point of saying it's not just a great Haruhi movie, it's just a great movie in general.
Yeah.
If Monogatari, this is definitely like for the fans.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's the kind of thing where like I'd say I'd recommend this movie to more people if they had the chance to see all three of them at once.
Yeah.
You know, but as a Monogatari fan, then this is what you've been waiting for. And I think the first movie is a success. It really, mm-hmm. I mean, it worked.
Yeah. I think that's a discussion we'll have to revisit by the time the third movie comes out, so that we have all the separated pieces and see, like, would these have been better altogether?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, we can glean a sense of that from the book, but I think we need to see Shaft's rendition of it.
Yeah, this is still only part one.
All right, so overall, the movie, expectations met?
I'd say they were pretty met.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of... there was okay. Well, I guess since we're still talking about the movie, I guess now's a good time to mention things that I was a little disappointed in. Since, oh, you know, overall, you can tell I really enjoyed it, but
mm-hmm.
Just comparing it to the visual or the book visual novel, just to the actual novel, I was looking forward to seeing, in the scene where he gives his blood to Kiss Shot. I was definitely looking forward to him, you know, before giving his blood, hesitating a little bit and then going to throw away his porn.
Yeah. Yeah, they left that part out.
Because in the book, of course, he narrates that, you know, while he was buying it, he's never such a weak man that he would try to camouflage it with something that's not porn
right.
at the cash register. And instead, he'd actually just buy two porn books.
Right.
But he was like, you know, the last thing I want is for someone to find my dead body and then for porn to be next to it.
Everybody's fears.
Yeah. He basically had the, you know, on the street version of hey, if I die, go delete everything on my computer.
My history and cookies.
So there was that. I was a little disappointed that was left out because that was a nice comedic beat. But it, I guess for the mood that they were going for and the tension, it just wouldn't have worked.
Right. Yeah. It would have been an odd bit of comedy.
Yeah. Then, even though there was still a slightly funny scene where when he picks her up, you know, to offer his blood, he the way he hugs her, he presses his face against her breast because he just has this contented smile on his face.
Uh-huh. And then they fall to the ground and then they bounce off the ground.
Yeah. It's played you know, it's played a little bit for laughs, but again, there was that, and what was the I think there was one more thing, but more or less, you know, I think they handled it really well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so now we're done with talking about the first movie. So if you don't want to know anything that happens in the rest of the other two movies that we're going to be talking about as we talk about the light novel, spoiler warning, let's get into it. So maybe we can continue from where the movie ended.
Yeah.
All right, so we have the battles. We have dramaturgy first, episode second, and guillotine cutter third. And throughout this process, you see Arataki starting to understand exactly what powers he has as a vampire, mm-hmm. and slowly applying them during these fights.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing here, just speaking for the book now, is that you can very clearly, you know, you have the prologue and the epilogue, but everything in the middle, you can actually very easily separate into three sections, right? You have him encountering, you know, his first encounter with Hanakawa, his first encounter with Kishot, when he first wakes up and learns everything from Kishot. Like, you have all of that as the first part of the book. Mm-hmm. But then the middle section basically becomes
a shonen.
Yeah, it becomes a shonen battle anime. Or manga. And that's almost like, that's so Nisio Isin to play with those kind of like those tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And another way that I sort of described it to myself was, oh, this is like a video game, you know, because he's fighting the bosses as he's slow learning his capabilities and whatnot. And, you know, with prizes on the line, like mm-hmm. where he's trying to get those artifacts back, which are her limbs. Right. And it sort of progresses from that point on as a bit of a, like, almost a video game.
Mm-hmm. So before all that, there's a scene with he meets Hanakawa again, and mm-hmm. he's trying to kind of, like, shoo her away. He's very being aggressive and kind of being mean toward her, trying to get her to stay away from him as he deals with all this stuff. And then we get to dramaturgy, who... And it's where we learned a little bit more about, like, their background and the fact that dramaturgy is a vampire hunting vampire.
Yeah.
And he understands Arataki's strength better than Arataki because he tries to recruit him and says, you would be number one in my clan.
Yeah. Dramaturgy is interesting because he's, you know, he's basically going after Arataki because it's his job. But right. He also, it's not his last resort. You know, he's like, if I can get you to join me, then yeah, let's work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he also understands that most vampires like that are, you know, were previously human. So he's trying to appeal to the humanity in Arataki.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even though he's a vampire himself.
Yeah. And so... during this fight, Arataki is worried about the dual blades that dramaturgy has. I forget what he calls them in the books.
Like Zweihanders or something like that. But yeah, you know, like they look like giant two-handed swords, but that he's wielding with one hand each.
Right.
But then he realizes that they're not actually he's not actually holding them. They are his arms. He's transformed them into swords.
Yeah. And then that's where we kind of learn about, like, you know, the whole thing about turning yourself into mist and superhuman strength.
Yeah, the fact that a vampire can change their body, transform their body.
Changing your form, yeah. And then during that point, Hanakawa sees them fighting because she's super, super persistent and just will not leave Artanagi alone.
She won't go home, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then they had an argument after that, and yeah, she decided, I'm just going to show you my panties again. And then
I can't remember. Was that when she gives him the pair of panties that she was wearing?
I believe that is a little, yeah, that's a little later.
Okay.
In the book. Yeah.
But in any case, I thought it was interesting during that fight with Dramaturgy that Artanagi realizes how actually powerful he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where he's like, okay, he's looking at this from the perspective of a human. He's like, okay, so Dramaturgy's a big dude, so he's probably going to be a little slower, so I can use my smaller frame to sort of outspeed him and this and that. And then he realizes, wait a second, I don't need to dodge attacks because my regeneration is so powerful that, like, I think it was like his arm was cut off at one point. And before it had even hit the ground, it evaporated and his arm was back.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he's like, I don't have to actually dodge any attacks when I could just, you know, hit him.
Uh-huh.
And he started, you know, like his method of attack was to sort of throw, you know, because at this point, Meme set up all the fights to take place on the athletic field for the of the high school. That's an important point.
And there's some foreshadowing with the magazines that he bought.
Yeah.
Like a baseball book. Karate.
He's like, he looked up a fighting, how to fight book, and then also a sports book. And those came in handy because that's how basically he was fighting, right? Mm-hmm. From what he had read. And it was when he went to buy those books that he ran into Hanakawa earlier.
Right.
But I digress. He, you know, at that point, he starts picking up like a shot put ball and throws it at Dramaturgy. Hits him square in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and at first Artanagi's like, you know, there's something off about the, you know, the way this feels. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, that was too light.
Uh-huh.
Because he realizes that he's so powerful that his strength was actually, you know, making his aim be off. So he picks up a freaking, like, what is it? Like, it's like a roller to flatten out fields.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. like, and he just picks it up one hand and he's about to throw it. He's like, yeah, this feels better. He's about to throw it at Dramaturgy. When Dramaturgy is like, I give up.
Yeah. And then that's when he kind of admits that, you know, I knew you were stronger than me, but that you mentioned about appealing to the human side of him, mm-hmm. and the recruitment.
And even then, but, you know, again, there's important foreshadowing here, too, because he talks about how, hey, you and I are in different classes of vampire because, you know, you talk about how your regeneration is so good. Mine's not as good as yours. He's like, I'm still recovering from that shot put to the face. Like, mm-hmm. that would screw me up for a long time if you hit me with that thing. So I'm just going to stop right here. And right. That's where you kind of sort of realize that, you know, Kiss Shot. When Meme describes her as the king of aberrations, you know, she's an aberration slayer. She's truly something above and beyond, right? And Artanagi at this point is her servant. So he's given power that should be along the lines that she had beforehand, you know, before she was reduced to a child.
Right. And then that battle ends with Artanagi breaking down and asking Hanakawa to be his friend. Thus decreasing his intensity as a human.
He finally gives in.
Yeah. And then there's a couple chapters where there's kind of like in between stuff about Oshino talking to Artanagi about how Kishot actually saved his life. And saved is a really interesting word to use there. I would say spared, if anything.
Well, yeah, that's the thing is, I guess we kind of glossed over it in the beginning, but you know, she for her to recover, because she was dying. She, you know, she had so much blood loss that she was like, "I need your blood." And he's like, "How much? All of it." And she's like, "Well, if I give you all my blood, I'm going to die." So at that point, you know, she basically creates a servant when she feeds off of him,
mm-hmm.
and you know, she also mentions that he's only the second servant she's ever created in over 400 years.
Right.
You know, and at that point, you're like, it's because she basically, it's not, I don't think it was more out of pity, but it was more out of gratitude,
mm-hmm.
you know, because like she, like I said, she literally broke down crying when he ran away, and he came back and he held her and was like, I'll give my life to you. Like, I think that's at that point that she realized that, you know, his, I guess his life meant a little something more.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so, yeah. So at that point she was willing to create a servant. And I think that, you know, at that point it becomes a little clearer later that, she was disappointed when he wanted to go back to being human.
Right.
And I guess we can talk about that a little bit later when it comes up again, but yeah.
Yeah. There's some mention about her first servant.
Mm-hmm. And that's more foreshadowing for later.
Right.
A later novel, later story.
Yeah, and then Arataraki brings Hanakawa into the cram school. Hanakawa sees Kiss Shot, but Oshino kind of stays away from it. He doesn't he's not really interested in making contact with her, and then she brings him some clothes and stuff and even brings him underwear. And then
That's one of the funny scenes in the book, because she's the entire time that Hanakawa's there, Kiss Shot is sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
She refuses to wake up, even though she is still coherent enough to say a few words.
Right.
And that's when Hanakawa finds Araragi's porn.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. She had found it, like, was it in the garbage can?
That's the thing is, and that's why I was a little disappointed that they sort of left it out in the movie, because it comes back. It's sort of a brick joke. It comes back at this point, and Kishot basically says that she saw how dear it must have been to him, the way he was gripping onto it. So after saving him, she went and grabbed it from the trash and brought it to the cram school him. and that's where Hanakawa finds it. And of course, it's the bespectacled class president edition of.
Right. and I think even as we talk about it now, like that'll still be a funny moment.
Yeah, I think they could still probably do it.
Right. Uh huh. Yeah. And then we have the Fight Furzes episode, where this time Hanakawa gets hurt in battle because episode Furzes cross at her, but Araragi's able to heal her with his own blood.
Yep, using his own vampire blood. And of course, episode is a half vampire.
Right.
What that necessarily means, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and they were kind of talking about like the conflict that he has of what side does he hate more of. The vampire or the humans.
So that part
in terms of the actual battle, it wasn't interesting, but it was the part of learning about episodes like inner turmoil as a half and half. I believe a muggle, they call that in Harry Potter or something.
He's half human, half vampire.
Yeah.
You know, that makes it really does make me question, like, because he's different from Araragi.
Mm-hmm.
Because like even in the series, when Araragi isn't quite human completely and he still has some vampiric traits left, he's not a half vampire. Like, so right. he's still a distinctly different entity from what Episode is. So I'm assuming did he have parents that were one was a vampire and one was a human?
Mm-hmm.
Can vampires and humans interbreed?
Right.
And you know, he was like, I don't have all the he's like, I don't have all the strengths of a vampire, but that means I have none of their weaknesses either.
Right. Let's see. Up next, he beats him, gets her other leg, and now she has the appearance of a 17-year-old. It's pretty similar to the teen chick look that we've seen.
Yeah.
I believe in like Nisei Mono, I want to say.
Yeah, it was Nisei Mono when he fought
Kage Nui.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Hanakawa comes and he wants her to stop coming, so she takes off her panties, gives them to him, and says, give these back to me after spring break.
Right, yeah.
At the start of the next school year.
Essentially what she was telling him was, don't die.
Right. and there's a really funny thing we'll have to get to with that at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Guillotine Cutter. And then this is when this is a full human, and this is when they start to really illustrate what their reasonings were for fighting Artodagi, mm-hmm. that they talk about Guillotine Cutter's sense of duty a lot as the as a leader of a church.
Of a cult, really.
Right. And then he starts by taking Hanakawa as a hostage, mm-hmm. and then this is when Koyomi starts to learn to turn his body into other things by taking his arms, putting them in the ground, and making them into plants that grabs a Guillotine Cutter from behind. And that's something he was also talking about in the book. Like, you know, if I were to live in the next life or something like that, I'd want to be a plant.
yeah, and, talking about that reincarnation.
And I think he was I'm trying to remember his thoughts exactly, but he was talking about how he didn't want to harm anyone or anything like that, but the argument was made that plants still consume water and sunlight and stuff or something like that.
My thing was that he could visualize how to transform into a weapon like the way that dramaturgy could.
Mm-hmm.
But he had spent so much time visualizing himself as a plant, even as a human.
Right.
That transforming into a plant like thing was easy for him as a vampire now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let's see. So that battle happens. He beats Guillotine Cutter. So now Oshino has all of her limbs. Or Kisshot has all of her limbs back. But what Oshino tells that surprises everybody that reads is that he stole her heart while she wasn't noticing.
Basically, yeah. So that's the big... That's pretty much the big reveal of the book is that, you know... you're thinking to yourself, Adedagi is so powerful when he's fighting these three guys. How in the world did she lose, even if all three of them were together?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a vampire who has all the experience of being a vampire, someone who, you know, is as powerful as she is, even if all three of them were to team up, how, you know, there's no way she could have lost originally, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the key comes in, is that she didn't have her heart. And she didn't even realize it, because Oshino took it from her as soon as she came into town.
Yeah, and that's what caused her to kind of feel weak at the moment.
That she was off her game.
Right.
and you know, like, what a crazy thing that, like, you can just remove her heart, and she's still as powerful as she was.
Right, yeah. Like, how do you, like, they would never show it, but I would like to see, like, ridiculousness of that scene, like animated even by Monogatari standards,
right? Like, how do you just remove somebody's heart without them noticing?
It's like he's doing like open heart surgery while she's sleeping.
Who knows? But yeah, so that's the big reveal. He gives it to her, gives it to Adedagi rather, to give back to her, you know, after everything was said and done.
Mm-hmm.
And she's at 100% full, full back to being human. And that's one thing that Mehmed basically said, like, he did it to maintain balance. That's the reason why he took her heart in the first place. But everything became unbalanced as soon as the three hunters showed up to town and you know, were basically bullying her.
Right.
But, at this point, he had showed, even in the movie, when he first is talking to Adedagi about helping him, he mentions that he respects or even admires that dedication that Kisshot has to returning him to being a human, because he knows what that means.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Adedagi this entire time isn't aware of, you know, how he's going to be returned back to being a human. He just knows that she's going to do that for him.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because he was kind of questioning, like, can you even do that? How do you do that? That was one kind of funny thing throughout the book, is that Hanakawa would do this research. Hey, here's this research on this supernatural stuff that elsewise in the world wouldn't even be believed. But we take it as fact.
Yeah. But anyway, she has all her she's back to being a human again. And...
Or not human, but her, like her adult, 27-year-old appearance, yeah.
Yeah, she's back to being an adult, and and she has her full power back, and she tests her abilities. and that was another funny scene where she talks about how she disappears for a moment and comes up behind him and says, I just circled the Earth 3.5 times. And he's like, what? And she's like, I'm clearly joking, because if it was 3.5 times, I would have been on the other side of the planet, right?
Yeah. a nice math joke in that scene. But then we have
That's when he has a conversation with her on the roof.
Right, yeah, about wanting to go back to human, and the way the conversation goes, he's almost kind of having second thoughts about it.
Yeah, because I mean, like, he's essentially thinking, like, well, I'd be with you. Like, that's the thing, is, like, he wouldn't be alone, and she wouldn't be alone. They'd be together in eternity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of the key here. Like, he's like, oh, she's, you know, when he's talking to her, he's like, she's really not that bad. She's the most human at, like, of the, you know, the vampire hunters and all that stuff. Like, she's just a normal woman that he's talking to. And he's like, you know, like, I could live with this.
Yeah. There's a naivete there. That's seen in later on when he goes back to the cram school and he sees her eating guillotine cutter. And he starts to realize, like, you know, this superhuman strength and all that stuff, it's nice, but I don't want to eat humans.
It was more like he finally realized the consequences of what he was doing.
Right.
Right? Like, he's like, oh, I've been helping a monster this entire time. And mm-hmm. and I just didn't see that because, you know, she was a little girl or a beautiful woman. And she's like, this is a thing that preys on humans. And, like, you know, the attitude that she had at the beginning when she was lying there in her own pool of blood, where she talked down to him as if he was, you know, food. Well, that's because that's what he is to her, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's like, even though I knew this as a fact, I just didn't want to realize it.
Right, right. And then you do the math on if she's been a vampire for that long. She's been alive that long.
Yeah, how many people she must have eaten? Yeah,
I think it's like one. They try to figure like one per 2 weeks or something, or maybe even one a month.
She was like, "I've probably eaten like maybe 6,000 humans or something in my entire life,
right?
Or something like that." But you know, the point, I can't remember if she says that to him then or not. But the point she was making was like the amount of people that I've killed is minor compared to the amount of people that have been killed by humans themselves.
Right.
Right. Right. In that same amount of time.
Which sort of like is their way of, like, you know, speaking back to Oshino's thoughts on balance. Like, it's not too bad. 6,000. You know,
compared to
the drop in the hat,
the millions that died in wars and stuff like that. But he's like, you know, he's still at that point. That's where everything comes crashing down on him. Right.
Right.
And, you know, talking about that scene where he walks in on her eating guillotine cutter, who had come back to, you know, after the fight and whatnot. I think that's a perfect place to end the second movie.
Right.
Just for him to see that reveal and see her eating a human, and like everything that happens after that, I think I can see being the crux of the third movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially for the second movie, it needs to end on that note, because I think it needs a really strong cliffhanger.
Yeah.
This first one, as enjoyable as it was, to just end like that was like kind of like a shock for me. Like, oh, movie's over. Whereas that scene will,
you know, clearly. I almost feel like it should have ended as soon as Oshino dropped in and stopped all three vampire hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that would have been a stronger impact if it had just ended there.
That's true. I agree. But for movie length, if they want to do free 50-minute movies, true, if that's what they're going to do, you would have had something where like this one would have been about 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And the next one would have been like an hour 10 or something.
Because, I mean, all that happened after that was just them talking,
right,
you know, about what they were going to do and how they were going to get her limbs back.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, yeah, I think at one point earlier in the novel, going back to the conversation they were having and him finding out that she was eating humans, they had talked about, you know, how does a vampire defeat another vampire if they're both immortal?
Right.
Right. And they realize, you know, they basically consume one another. Right. Mm-hmm. Because that was like they were talking about, like, why did he become a vampire? If she was always eating, you know, drinking the blood of humans up to that point, and she had only made two servants, how does one avoid those people becoming vampires? Like, if just the act of having your blood drank makes you a vampire, right? So she's literally consuming her victims.
Uh-huh.
So that they cannot become vampires. That's essentially how you also handle a vampire, you know, when you're fighting one-on-one, is you have to consume their essence.
Yeah. And they were mentioning that, like, even standing out in the sun, that wouldn't kill you because you would just burn, reform, and then burn. It would just be like a living hell.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we could talk about, before we get to the main sort of ending of the book, we could talk about this first draw that she had from like 400 years ago, I believe, where after a while he wanted to die. That was like only like a few years after of being her thrall.
Yeah. And that was another thing. That was back when they were talking on the roof, right? Mm-hmm. She was talking about like the fact that, you know, vampires die all the time, and she essentially was like, they die because of suicide. Suicide mm-hmm. is the number one
boredom.
Yeah. Cause of death for vampires. And it wasn't even, I think it was like, you know, boredom was one thing, but like, you know, that's also a key plot point there. When you think about it, talking about the suicide aspect of it, is because, you know, who wants to live that long, first of all? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if you're by yourself, even more, why would you want to live that long?
Right. Like, even, you know, thinking on history, like, so much has changed in like 500 years relative to our world. But even then, how much of that would you be interested in seeing before everything starts to feel boring and, you know, very repetitious, because you probably see like the same behaviors in humans for like that long a period of time.
Yeah, but even then, you're a creature that can only exist at night. You know, you're not even a part of human society anymore, and you use them to feed. Mm-hmm. So you can only travel the world so many times. Mm-hmm. So anyway, like he runs away from her after seeing that, and you know he's thinking to himself, I have to die.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to feed, you know, I don't want to feed on humans. I, you know, I've basically helped a monster. I have to die. Yeah. So he fully intended to go into battle with her, you know, with death in mind.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is where he has another conversation with Hanakawa.
Yeah. He hides in the PE shed, which had been referenced throughout the book in battles because it was broken and then repaired. So
that's where he had put Hanakawa during the fight with Dramaturgy, was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh shoot, I'm not 100% sure. Well, he didn't see Hanakawa until after that fight.
Right.
So it had to be episode. But thinking Tia deleted her number, it was still in his contact. So calls her, she comes in, and is, you know, talk about all this nervousness and kind of explains everything. And then this will be a really interesting moment to see animated in the series too, is he wants to grab her breasts.
Or rather, didn't she offer, or, oh, she was like, I'll do anything for you.
Yeah. And then that's the suggestion he makes. And he rationalizes it as, you know, Kishot has very large breasts and I don't want to be caught, like, you know, staring or anything like that in the midst of battle.
Fight, right?
Yeah.
So he's like, I need to get this off my mind before I go into battle.
Yeah. And she's willing to do it. And she even does like the dirty talk to where it almost seems consensual.
Oh, she wanted it for sure.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then she was pretty disappointed, as I think all readers were.
When he chickens out.
Yeah, chickens out. And, oh, don't grab your shoulders. And then that's when Kishot finds him, tears down the shed, and then that's when they start engaging in battle, and there's the talk about, like, how do you remove yourself as, like, a vampire, and, like, the idea of just simply fighting your master would have kind of ridded you of that vampire status. So they fight, and it seems like it's going to be an all-out brawl animation-wise, as they just, you know, punch each other and tear off limbs, and they regrow and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, that battle comes to a head, and then Oshino steps in, and that's where he says what Araragi said at the beginning of the book, which is, this will not end well for anybody.
Yeah. You know, he basically starts consuming her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to finish her off. But that's when he finally realizes the truth behind everything. You know, it's like one reveal after another that she wanted to die from the very beginning.
Right.
You know, like, when she first came to town, she was looking for a place to die. And, you know, he asked herself, but you the way you cried and pleaded when you were about to die, you know, like, and she's like, well, that's because I was faced with that reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then she says that I was faced with that reality and I became afraid. And when Araragi became a vampire by saving her, the only way that he was ever going to return to being a human again was for her to die, for her to be consumed by him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in that sense, very much like Araragi, she was like, okay, I can give my life for that. Because mm-hmm. at that point, it wasn't so much about just committing suicide. It was more, from her perspective, it was more of a noble sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's having known, like, Shinobu for so long, it's kind of unique to see the very beginning of how compassionate she was. And
right.
I believe,
like, Oshino, how much she actually cared about Araragi.
Right.
Yeah, even from the beginning.
Yeah, and Oshino explains, like, the meaning of her last name, Heart Under Blade, sort of saying that she, underneath her blade, her Aberration Slayer, that she does have a heart, and that she does have, and she shows this compassion in the novel.
That's what I'm saying. And, you know, that's the thing is, like, you know, I think one of the important themes of this book is, like, you know, what's the difference between a monster and a human, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she is 100% a monster. She is a vampire, but at the same time, she has these emotions. She has these feelings. And Araragi can't just let her, like, you know, he's like, I'm going to kill her because she's a monster. Mm-hmm. But then he realizes, oh, she wanted to die because she was lonely. Like, that's why at the very beginning, when she is so disappointed by the fact that he wants to go back to being human, I think she was having second thoughts about killing herself.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was like, you know, if I finally met someone who I right. could spend eternity with.
Mm-hmm.
But he, again, like, even as a, like her first thrall, he didn't want to be a vampire.
Right.
And at that point, I think she resolved herself to basically dying for him to go back to being a human again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really, really strong stuff when you think about it.
Like, it's super depressing because, like, you know, at that point, Araragi was going full tilt. Like, he's like, I'm going to kill her because I can't let her continue to feed off humans. But then he realizes that she wanted to die, and he's like, I can't let her die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I can't help her commit suicide.
Right.
And that's when Oshino comes up with the only solution that will end with nobody being happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is Oshino goes back to, like, the appearance of an 8-year-old. Koyomi is, like, half human, half vampire.
Yeah, he consumes her just enough so that she loses her vampiric self.
Mm-hmm.
He returns back to being mostly human, and the only way she can survive is by feeding off his blood on a regular basis.
Right. And that's how we're able to see, like, her teenage form.
Yeah. Later she regains more of her vampiric self as she, you know, consumes his blood.
Right.
And at the same time, he becomes more vampiric too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that is, unless I'm missing something at the very end, I believe that's exactly how the book ends.
That's essentially the end. It basically ends right as spring break is ending. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the time frame of this, it happens right in between school years. So he has just finished being a second year, but he hasn't really started his third year of high school yet. in relation to the other books, other stories, so it's basically going into April. Golden Week is when Neko Monogatari happens, and the incident with Hanakawa where, you know, she meets a Sawari Neko, the harmful cat.
Right.
And that happens during Golden Week, which is in May. And Bakemonogatari happens literally like 2 days after that.
Right.
Or even like the very next day, he meets Hitagi, Sendragahara.
Mm-hmm.
So it all happens pretty close to each other, within his, you know, right at the beginning of his third year of high school.
So this is the chronologically first in the series, and what I thought was interesting in reading it is how it really felt like the first in the series, and how we didn't read like I would expect Bakemono to read or mm-hmm. Niseimono to read. It felt like Nisio really did a nice job of sort of writing the prequel story to feel truly like the beginning and unique. And you see that like in the animation of how different that is, which Shaft does a nice job of.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, anyone like for example, some of the people that went with us to see the movie, I told them, you know, they were like, oh, but I haven't seen any of Bakemonogatari. I don't know what's going on. I was like, you know, you don't have to. This is literally the beginning. Mm-hmm. And even Vertical, when they published the book over here, it wasn't their decision to start with Kizu Monogatari. The original publisher actually said you should start with Kizu because right. It's the first in the series mm-hmm. chronologically.
If I'm correct, I think he says that at the end.
Yeah. Nisio Eason himself, even in the afterword, which is in the book here, the translated version, mm-hmm. says, you know, you can start with this one or you can start with Bakemonogatari. It doesn't really matter.
Could have been in like the foreword or something.
Yeah. In fact, I'm turning to it right now.
I'm saying it should have been in the foreword, not in the afterword.
Oh.
It's like, how about you start the book with that?
He says, this book consists of Koyomi Vamp, the story of Koyomi Araragi. Mm-hmm. He's the narrator of Bakemono. He's like, though I called it my previous work, I don't mind at all if you read this one first. In fact, chronologically speaking, this one comes first, so I dare say that Kizu Monogatari First Order is just as legit as the opposite order.
mm-hmm.
And that comes from straight from the word of the author, so don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
And now with so much Monogatari anime, I would say, like, if anybody hasn't ever watched any, you know, go ahead and try from the start. I mean, you might have to wait a little while for these movies to come out, depending on if they're at your theater or not. But, you know, if you're really hungry, go ahead and give Bakemono a watch, because I think that's a great entry point
mm-hmm.
for the Monogatari series, because it's one thing that I've been thinking about ever since I've been reading the book is that Bakemono is where the essence of what Monogatari is and how people know it as started.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I would say just go ahead and get the book for Kizu Monogatari too. It's right now I'm looking up on Amazon. It's $10.75.
Right. Really good deal.
The cover price is $14.95. You can get it for super cheap on Amazon. And like, I mean, seriously, why not? I think we should really support these light novel translations so that we continue getting more stuff like this.
Right.
Because
we've had different fan translations for a while for this. But I mean, it was a PDF and you had to upload on your Kindle and the formatting was just poor.
Yeah.
You know, I liked Vertical's presentation of the book.
But just talking about the quality of the book itself, I think Vertical's put out a really great book. It's like 344 pages long. It's on pretty large text, so even though it's about 300 pages long, it's a pretty easy read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know I finished it in just a few days. And really I didn't want to put it down while I was reading it because I was enjoying it that much.
Mm-hmm.
But just talking about the quality of the book itself, cover is absolutely gorgeous. The inside art actually has the original cover art for the Japanese version.
Mm-hmm.
So you know you're getting a new cover for the English release, but you're also getting the original artwork for the Japanese release too.
Right. And then the faux fan illustrations.
Yeah. So that was a really great, really great package there. And again, you're getting it for a good price. So I highly recommend it. Vertical has already announced that they're releasing Bakemonogatari at the end of this year.
Mm-hmm.
In an interesting move, it's going to be 3 volumes.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, they're all coming out 1 month apart. So starting December, then January and February, you'll get all 3 volumes of Bakemonogatari. And I'm definitely looking forward to finally reading those.
That's good. While I doubt this to be the case, I'm going to check and make sure to see if there's not a digital version, because I know there might be some people that would prefer interested. That.
And also, I guess we should mention this too. Kizumonogatari apparently is getting a audiobook.
Oh, right. Yeah. Christina V is going to be the voice of
Kiss Shot.
Yeah.
And Hanakawa.
Yeah. So that'll be pretty interesting to I'm going to buy that and listen to it just to kind of experience the novel again.
Yeah.
This time in like a verbal.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great to listen to back and forth from work.
Right.
And this will be the first time that we hear anything Monogatari in English.
Right.
So that'll be an experience in and of itself.
Yeah, Aniplex just releases the subtitled versions of of what they've released so far. So this will be the first actual dubbing of Monogatari, which is nice.
You know, and I guess it works. It totally makes sense for it to be an audiobook, because the problem always has been like, how do you fit all that dialogue into the animation with the wordplay and all that stuff? But with an audiobook, you have unlimited amount of time to, say whatever you need to say.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify on the book thing, I'm not seeing a digital version. Like, I'm on Amazon and they don't have like a version for Kindle.
But like I said, it's easy. You don't even have to go to a bookstore. You can just have it delivered straight to you.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned at the very beginning that this was the first novel for the Monogatari series that I read, and the first one before seeing Shaft put their flavor on it. And, that was really enjoyable to read so much of Artaragi's dialogue. It's it's something that we've known of the series, as anime fans, but to see that like turned up to 11 in the novel, it was like, just incredible to get so much more of his insight.
Yeah. I found that also looking at this from a literary perspective, the whole thing is told first person perspective. I found that I kind of enjoy that style most when it comes to reading these novels. Like Haruhi is another one where it's told completely in that perspective.
Right.
And what's nice is that, you really get inside Araragi's head. He is sort of an unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you're literally seeing the world through his eyes and as he sees it, and as a horny teenager, like when he's looking at these women and this is what he's seeing, like, of course that's what the book writing is going to focus on, because that's what he's seeing,
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, that's if that's kind of the style that you like as well, that's another reason to check it out.
Yeah. I mean, there's benefits and I guess shortcomings. I'm not sure if that's the right word I'm looking for there of that style where, it kind of, you contain it to one person, but to make it work, that person has to be interesting. And Araragi is interesting.
Yeah.
Of a character. Same for Kion, of course. You have to develop a really strong, likable, and in ways relatable lead for that to work.
All right. So any last thoughts on it?
I really enjoyed the book enough so that I'm looking forward to reading Bakemonogatari when that comes out. And I'm really, I'd like to read as much as I can of it. It's the first light novel that I've actually taken the time to read. We've seen enough series with light novels and I felt like, High School DxD, that might be interesting to read. Some of these other series, Steins Gate visual novels. This is one of the first times that I've seriously dove deep into the story of a series. And I think Monogatari is an interesting one for that.
Oh yeah, I think it's one that seriously deserves the releases it's finally getting. Mm-hmm. It's not my first visual novel or light novel. I keep saying visual novel. It's not my first light novel. Like I said, I'd read the Haruhi series, and you know, I've delved into a couple of other ones as well. But seriously, it's one of the ones I'm most happy to have right alongside the Haruhi novels, because you know the animation is great. But you really want to get that kind of that origin for it, right? Like where mm-hmm. that prose is coming from, where that narration, all that stuff is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different experience from the anime itself, but you know it was great nonetheless.
Yep, I agree. All right, so listeners, that's been our EXT on Kizumono Gatari Part 1. Thank you for listening. We hope that with the next movie coming out in summer and whenever the third movie comes out, that we get back to do shorter EXTs on this, since we won't be talking about the entirety of the book. We'll kind of just be comparing
mm-hmm.
the book to the movie in those select chapters and scenes.
We're hoping that, you know, we get to see all three movies in a theater. We saw the first one, so... An interesting thing that I should note is that like our local theater, basically they took suggestions, they got in contact with the distributor Aniplex, and they were able to get a screening. So if you have any local cinema houses and that sort of thing in your area, you know, get in contact with them, see if they'll get the next movie for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they'll send a Blu-ray to that theater, and then you'll see the menu screen for like an LG Blu-ray player at the end.
that was pretty funny. My favorite thing was, well, you know, like what's interesting is, since the runtime on this movie is so short, if they do screen the second movie, I wouldn't be surprised if some places actually do a double screening of the first and the second movie together.
But that would be cool,
right?
I would go see that, because it's just like 2 hours.
Exactly, it's the regular runtime of a movie anyway.
And even all three movies together,
yeah,
it would just be. I'm kind of curious. Like, I just finished Fate's Day Night Unlimited Blade Works, and I was talking to people about how I watched it without openings and endings, just playing the episode straight, and how they flow so well into each other. Kind of curious, like, to see that flow a little bit in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so thank you for listening, and hopefully we, you know, we'll obviously see you next time on the podcast, hopefully with the Kizumono Gatari EXTs in the summertime. For Amuro, I'm Jero. We will see you next time on the podcast. Believe it.